My name's Glenn Langton. As you can see from my grey hair, I have been an actuary for a long, long time. And I'd have to say, for most of those years, I've known Colin as a colleague and as a friend. Recently, we've been working closely together because Colin is the convener of a superannuation practice, superannuation projections and disclosures subcommittee, and Colin convenes that subcommittee and is very active in making it do what it does. Just a bit of background for Colin. He's a semi-retired actuary and a superannuation consultant. He's currently an associate director of SuperEasy Proprietary Limited. And as I said, he's the convener of the Superannuation Projections and Disclosure Subcommittee. Anyone that's known Colin for a while knows he's had a long-standing passion for stochastic and historical investment simulation modelling, and has written three previous ICA papers and six Australian Institute papers about such models. He's the designer and owner of AustMod Investment Simulation Model. Prior to his semi-retirement, and I think Colin's still coming to grips with what that actually means, Colin held a variety of superannuation actuarial investment roles with National Mutual, culminating in appointment of with NMFM as a senior actuary. The structure of the presentation today, Colin will speak for 20 to 25 minutes. Then we'll have about 20 minutes of questions. Then Colin will speak again for about 20 to 25 minutes, and then we'll finish off with any other questions you have. Colin asked me to also just give Tom Seddon's apologies. He was actually going to do the second presentation, but he couldn't make it today. So I think I'd best introduce Colin to take us away.
Thank you, Glenn, and good afternoon, everybody. From today's presentation, we hope that you'll gain at least three takeaways. First takeaway is that setting investment assumptions is not a trivial matter. Second, that economic cycles and investment performance cycles are significant and important. And thirdly, that negative autocorrelations may be more relevant and useful than mean reversion. This first slide is just a quick overview of the 58-year period that the paper is based on. It shows in purple 5-year rolling investment returns for a typical balanced portfolio, and similarly 5-year average returns for average weekly ordinary time earnings and CPI. We chose 5-year rolling averages for this slide because we wanted to get rid of the noise, but we wanted to retain some of the main features. A couple of those features are that back in 1974-77, average weekly ordinary time earnings was running at greater than 15% per annum. And then 2 or 3 years later, it actually fell below CPI, and then again in this period there from 1987 to 1991, there was less than CPI. But more importantly, just looking at the slide, it's very evident that if you set assumptions for the future based on this period through there, you're going to get very different results to what you'd get if you were to include that period back there. So it's very time critical. The presentation will briefly cover why the paper was written, what it contains, and some of the results. The paper is 88 pages and it's got 82 charts and 30 tables. So there's no way in this short presentation that I can do it complete justice. This will be very much an overview. And if there's areas that you're particularly interested in, I suggest you take note of the section references. It'll either be on the slides or which I will make in the presentation. Why did we write the paper? The key reason was that both Tom and myself feel that there's a demand versus supply gap. For many sectors, for many practitioners, there's a shortage of data for long-term assumptions. And surprisingly, there's very little documented methodology for setting assumptions, both in Australia and overseas, something that I find quite surprising. And Tom has struck it in his practical experience. The demand pull issues are obvious. As actuaries, we use investment assumption in all practice areas for a raft of calculations, assessments, projections, and premium calculations. There's plenty of demand. We'll admit to two supply push matters. Tom and myself are fortunate to have access to what we believe is a valuable 58-year database. The database draws on information from the National Mutual EFG investment system during the period 1965 to 2009 and supplements that with a lot of information from published indices and rates over periods of 8 to 58 years. Tom and myself are also keen to encourage Australian actuaries to make greater use of stochastic models, historical simulations and scenarios, as well as autocorrelations and economic cycles. There are two main aspects to the paper. First, it deals with investment performance results and trends over the 58-year period. And secondly, based on those results and trends, by a methodology that I'll explain in a moment, we determine various investment assumptions. Slides that relate to assumptions, you'll find, have got an orange glow around their border, just to distinguish them from performance. The assumptions are intended to be for medium term, which we define as 3 to 10 years, or the long term, which we define as 10 to 60 years. The assumptions, we hope, are realistic, and we hope and believe that they are suitable for both stochastic and deterministic models. There are 15 sectors in our database. There are 5 growth securities, 6 interest income, and 4 financial indicators. Section 3 of the paper gives full details of the database. 2 of the 5 financial indicators, which are useful for picking up liability characteristics, are the 90-day bill rate and the 10-year bond rate. We hold those deliberately in the model mid-year to get a better correlation against cash and loan investment performance or investment rates, returns. As I said, section 3 of the paper's got all the details. Section 4 of the paper explains how some of the data was backdated back to 1959, often by use of a prior data series, such as before AWOTE commenced being published, we used AWE for the previous periods. But where that technique wasn't possible, in a few cases, we've used the method of least squares and applied it to like sectors and known features. The known features might be the exchange rate or changes in the bond rate or rates of inflation, etc. There are two lots of results. The key results are in the top left-hand corner of this slide and include risk margins expressed as the margin over the 10-year bond rate. In section 6 of the paper, we explain that it is useful for the purpose of determining risk margins to lag the bond rate by 15 months. By lagging it by 15 months, you get a much more stable and reliable correlation with the fixed interest sectors in particular. If you think about it, that's of course a function of the duration of the fixed interest portfolios. The Schooner, Skirtasis and correlations are all based on forces, and there are two cross correlations in the results. There's the cross correlation of the ranks that we refer to as rank cross correlations, and there's cross correlations of the actual data. I'll explain a bit more about this later. For information, I'll get the hang of this in a minute. Section 8 of the paper has got arithmetic means, compound means, standard deviations, and balanced and capital stable results over 44-year periods. And I'll explain why 44 years in just a moment. At section 17 of the paper has got gross and net of superannuation tax assumptions, and section 18 of the paper expresses the assumptions gross and net of wholesale passive fees. Section 211 of the paper explains that our model, in common with a lot of other Australian stochastic models, takes the input based on arithmetic means and arithmetic risk margins, does all the calculations based on forces, and in our model shows the output in both arithmetic and compound means. This slide shows 44-year average compound returns from the database. It includes every third year down the bottom, plus the latest year. And a year for this purpose is actually the average of 4 years. So for 2003-04, it's the average of years ending September 93, December 93, March 04, and June 04. The key feature from this particular slide is the recovery in international shares since 2012-2013. The next slide is a similar type but with different sectors, including capital stable. Note that on this basis, the 44-year returns for Australian fixed interest are fairly similar to cash. You can also note that average weekly ordinary time earnings is decreasing over the period, and in the final period is 6.8%, whereas CPI is fairly stable, and in the final period is 5.3%. The difference between the two being representing productivity increases is 1.5%. But if that trend there continues down, we could expect that the productivity margin will be something less than 1.5% in years to come. Section 9 of the paper analyses the impact of the global financial crisis on a balanced portfolio. This first slide shows a graph of the unit price starting at 1859 and then displaying the power of compound interest increasing up to 975 at 3907. And then in the next 18 months, because of the global financial crisis, it fell 34.3%. before climbing back up 120% in the next 8.25 years. The slide at the bottom or the chart at the bottom, is exactly the same information on a log scale, together with an exponential trend line, which shows up as a straight line on the log scale, and then comparing the blue curve against the straight line, you can see that the post-GFC results are fairly similar in their impact to the post-1972 oil crisis results. This similarity is explored a bit on the next few slides. First, we discounted the unit price. We discounted the unit price by the average earnings of 9.32% experienced during the 58 years. So by design, the discounted unit price starts at 8, all the investment performance is discounted out of it, and it ends at 8. But the use of this is technique is that we can now locate the peaks. And you can see the four distinct peaks in the data. 31.1272, 39.87, 36.2000, and the global financial crisis 39.07. This is all quarterly data, so it doesn't precisely pick up the actual peaks, just the peaks based on quarterly data. Next, we look at the log of the unit price and set the log price back to zero at each peak. This then picks up what's happened following each peak. For peaks B and C, there's nothing very exciting. In fact, it displays very shallow falls and then the recovery. But peaks A and D are quite interesting. Peak A is 31st December 1972, and for the first 3 years, it followed a very similar path to the red curve, which is the global financial crisis. But then from the three-year point, the recovery of the red has fallen behind the recovery of from the oil crisis, primarily due to lower fixed interest returns in recent years. Returning for a moment to the discounted unit price, or actually the log of the discounted unit price, we fitted a polynomial trend to it, which was the average of 4 degrees and 5 degrees. The reason for that choice is that 4 degrees and 5 degrees, which are shown in faint lines behind the graph, are both very poor fits at the start and end of the period. But perhaps fortuitously, the average of the two of them is quite a good fit throughout the whole period and at the start and the end. Then we looked at the periods between the maximums and the periods between the minimums based on the trends. The former period was 43.25 years and the latter period is 42.5 years. So you start to get a feel for where our 44 years came from. Section 5 of the paper examines economic cycles, and we recommend that you make an effort to at least read that section. Section 5.1 explains that examining the persistency and characteristics of past economic cycles has four benefits. First, and importantly, it helps the researcher understand the data. Secondly, when setting assumptions, it guards against the danger of confusing a long-term trend with the downside or upside of a long cycle. Thirdly, it may indicate the need to allow for future economic cycles in long-term assumptions. And fourthly, it's essential for setting initial cycle positions if the long-term assumptions allow for cycles or autocorrelations. For our OSMOD model, we do allow for autocorrelations, so therefore we need a cycle position to pick up the autocorrelations. This next slide shows annual bond forces at quarterly intervals. Covers the period from June 1950 to June 17, and then the trend curve has been continued outwards to June 2043. Although the purpose of this work is to look backwards, we want to find and have an understanding of past economic cycles. Nevertheless, curiosity, we projected it forward. What we have the curve fitting involved is the optimum sum of two sine curves. To get the optimum, we actually discounted the data by 0.5% a quarter. Now, 0.5% a quarter doesn't sound very much, but for example, it means that data before December 1971 only gets a 40% weight in this work. So it's quite significant. But we also show for sensitivity testing the results in section 5 with a zero discount, so you can pick up the impact of it. And it's not highly significant. The results for a discount of zero are fairly similar. Each of these slides shows an orange curve, which is the trend that we got 4 years ago. The purple curve for bonds is the sum of a 26.5 sine curve and a 62.5 sine curve. Down the bottom corner, we've showed the percentage of the sum of the squared residuals, which is captured by the curve fitting. I think in statistics they refer to this as the R squared test. It's a very high 93.3% for bonds. That's the highest percentage that I've seen in any of this work for a number of years. The period between the minimums, or the minima, is 56.5 years. And for the purpose of the OSMOD model, we note that the bottom of the fitted curve, if the fitted curve has some merit for the future, is June 2021, which is 4 years after the end of the data period. So this gives us some information about setting the autocorrelation assumptions for the model. The same information for CPI, but now, once again, you see that the purple curve is a bit longer than the orange curve, so the cycles are getting longer. For CPI, the fit is only 56.7% because of the more volatile inflation curves. That's one of a number of reasons why I actually prefer to measure against the bond rate rather than inflation, because inflation is more volatile. The period between the minimums is 50.5 years, and also there's an intervening cycle starting to emerge, which has got a period of 18.25. A WATI is a bit similar, but there are some differences. Again, the purple curve is a little bit longer, but not by very much. But now we have a very distinct intervening period, which has a length between minima of 24.5 years compared to 57.75 on the longer basis. Again, the fit is about 56.0%, similar to inflation. Instead of using two sine curves, the next slide uses a single sine curve. For bonds, again shown in purple, it's a pretty good fit. It's it picks up 80.6% of the sum of the squared residuals with just one fitting, one optimum sine curve. This slide also shows the optimum AWOTI single curve and the optimum CPI single curve. A couple of things to note from this. First of all, the bond curve reaches a minimum in September 15, whereas the AWOTI curve reaches its minimums in September 08, or reached its minimum, and the CPI reached its minimum in 2005. So CPI has led bonds by 10 years, and AWOTI has led bonds by 7 years. This lead and lag is examined in section 14 of the paper, and we put forward the idea that for some purposes you can get more stable results if you lag AWOTI and CPI by 8 years. Now, these last five slides have shown economic cycles ranging from 18.25 to 69.5 years. Section 518 of the paper is a summary which summarises all of the various periods and takes a weighted average, which is the 44 years. 44 years happens to be the same result we got 4 years ago. Now, before moving away from these slides, these curve fittings, we also applied it to Australian shares. And again, we have annual forces at quarterly intervals. But of course, we've got very volatile share forces. And the curve fitting is only 20.4%. The resultant optimum curve is 3.381 years plus 8.98, or nearly 9 years. So the sum of those two curves produces the optimum fit. And you can see the resulting trend lines on the right-hand side. But to get an idea of what's going on here, we've taken a close-up. So it's the same information, but we've magnified the 30 years in the middle. And now you can see that the curve fitting since 2012 has actually done a pretty good job of picking up the fluctuating performance of the share market. And if this was to have any validity, it shows that the share market annual forces will fall to negative by June this year and before starting to increase again. At this point, I'll break and give people the opportunity for some questions, preferably based on the areas that I've covered, which are shown on this slide.
All right. Now, anyone who wants to ask a question, they need to wait till the microphone comes. Anyone who wants to ask a question? Come on. Here we go, John.
Colin, I'm just wondering about the use of the sine curves when, you know, especially where you've only got, you know, one peak at the start of some data, a data set, and another peak at the end of a data set. I mean, you can say, that combination of sine curves produces a good fit to the data on bonds, but to what extent would we really trust the projection beyond the fitting period?
I'd like to stress that this was not done for projection purposes. Why this was done was to get an understanding of past cycles. That was its purpose. The purpose was not to project forward. But our curiosity just couldn't help us. Having done that, we're just curious as to what it showed. And I found it quite surprising that that's what it produces. It's just the outworkings of the sine curves that have been fitted to the past data. It has, to me, some realism, but that's not its purpose. Its purpose is to find the past economic cycle, because we don't want to set assumptions based on half a cycle or based on 1.5 cycles. We want to set assumptions based on a full economic cycle, whatever that is, or whatever an average is. We want to avoid using half a cycle for assumption setting purposes, because half a cycle is a very distorted period. That's its purpose. This is just curiosity. Except for my Ostmod model, it does require, if you want to pick up current investment conditions, it does require knowledge of where you think the bond rate might turn. But if you run the model in long-term mode, you don't require that.
Can I just pursue that sort of the methodology, as I understand it? Basically, your assumptions are based on what you expect the results to be in the next couple of years. In fact, is it 4 years and you sort of take the average? But anyway, so it's based on an extrapolation of the trends that you've actually identified. So with bonds, are you actually using the next 4 years of that?
So
where do they come from?
Can I leave that, Glenn, because you've moved into the second area, which is assumptions. At this point, all I'm looking at is experience. I'm happy to move on if you like, and there'll be more time for questions at the end.
I was looking at the historical performance of, I guess, Australian equities and international equities. I was curious as to why, or what, just your thoughts on why Australian equities may have outperformed international equities.
Australian against
international. Yep. I just saw on that chart that Australian seemed to consistently outperform over international. I was just curious.
You're again in the assumption area. It's the assumptions that do that. So could I just raise the question again, please, if I don't answer it? Yeah.
Well, okay, I'll try again on a question that's on the data. Why did you focus, Colin, on the unhedged data? Or Aussie dollar-denominated international shares, which has all the FX noise in it, rather than their currency? Because I think half of that is to do with our currency movement that's buried in there.
Okay. I have both international hedged and unhedged as two of the sectors. This work on shares was done at the request of the deceased Ron McDonald. Ron saw all the work that I'd done on AWOTI and CPI and the bond rate and said to me, well, why don't you apply it to shares? So that's what I did. But it was purely for information. The share work doesn't impact on the modelling or the setting of assumptions. It was just for curiosity. Okay, I think we should move on to assumptions, because then there's another opportunity for further questions at the end. The methodology for setting assumptions that we've used is set out in section 2 of the paper. It involves 6 steps. The first step, and this applies to all the assumptions, be they means, kurtosis, skewness, autocorrelations, or what, they all follow these 6 steps. It's important because we want consistent results. The first step is to, instead of looking at 58 years of information, we look at 4 lots of 57 years. 57 years ending September, 57 years ending December, 57 years ending March, and 57 years ending June. Now we've got 4 times 57, we've got 228 years of observations. Now I know that they're dependent, but they give you a lot more information over those 228 years than you'll get over the 58 years of independent. Particularly when we're looking at yearly performance. So the yearly performance for the year to December is just as informative as the yearly performance for the year to June for modelling purposes. I know you might give some weight to June for other purposes. Step one. Step two we've covered. Step two is determine the period that you wish to do the the work over, and we chose 44 years for the reasons I've just explained. Then determine your annual statistics for the chosen period, 40 of, and we used 40 years as an alternative for risk margins and coefficients of variation. The reason for that is we just wanted a small band of results, so we had a bit of flexibility in setting the final assumptions. But we only did that for risk margins and coefficient of variation. Step four is we took 14 running averages of the four quarter end results. So the first of the 14 periods were referred to as period 13, and the last of the 14 periods were referred to as period naught. And period naught is the average of 44 years ending September 16, averaged with 44 years ending December 16, and 44 years ending March 17 and June 17. Step five is we fitted a weighted quadratic trend to those 14 running averages, and we did a six-year projection. And then step six was to focus on period minus two, which is the second year of the projection. And in some cases, not in many cases, a little bit of professional judgment. And I'll give you a couple of examples in a moment, but for most of the time, we used the second year of the projection. The main reason for using the second year of the projection is that we feel that assumptions like this have got a life of about 2 years, and after 2 years, they should be reviewed and reset. So that was the main reason for focusing on the second year. But also, the further out you go in the projection, the more doubt you have about the results. I feel far more comfortable with the second year, or perhaps the third year, because as years go by, I'm getting more comfortable with the trend fitting and polishing some of the detail. So I'd be tempted to use perhaps 3 years next time around. Couple of examples, and there are actually 54 of these charts in the paper, so you're only seeing two of them. This particular one is shares and international shares. International shares on a unhedged basis. For domestic shares, the red curves are the 14 running averages that I explained before at step four. The green curve is the trend fit, quadratic trend fit, weighted towards the end of the periods. The orange curve is the result that we got 4 years ago. Notice that the current risk margins are more stable than they were back there as a result of the 4 years of further information. The focus is on the 2 year point, which is somewhere there, which is 4.9 for risk margins for Australian shares. Then comes the professional judgment, and in this case, we had an assumption of 4.0 4 years ago. We averaged the 4.0 with the 4.9, and we're now using 4.4 in the new assumptions. That doesn't mean we did that sort of thing every time. We just felt it was appropriate for Australian shares. For international shares, the professional judgment was to combine the results with the results for listed property trusts, because there are some similarities in the overall results, and more logical results came by combining the two. That was probably one of the most extreme professional judgments. But taken individually, they produce some strange results, but taken together, they produce logical results. So for international shares, if you took the two-year point, you'd get a result of 2.3. Our assumption was actually 3.0 for both international shares and listed property trusts. The coefficient of variation is the standard deviation divided by the mean. The two-year result with a little bit of rounding, is 1.616. That strange rounding is because if you multiply 1.616 by the determined arithmetic mean, you get 16.0. So what we're really saying is that the assumed standard deviation for shares is 16.0%. The coefficient of variation for international shares is fairly similar. This slide, just a quick refresher for those that have forgotten what skewness and kurtosis is. This just shows that for a uniform distribution in blue, you get that distribution, and a normal distribution that's got a skewness of zero, and it's got a kurtosis of minus 19 because we've got discrete periods. It would be zero if we had continuous periods. But it's very different from the results for direct property using our new assumptions, because for direct property we have a kurtosis of 304%, which is fairly high, and a skewness of minus 148, which is giving rise to the left-hand tail. You can see that the purple distribution is very different from the normal. For skewness, the same sorts of results. Just to mention that when I first started doing this work about 14 years ago, the skewness for shares was very close to zero. And so was the skewness for international shares. It was also very close to zero. But nowadays, it's very definitely negative. And the new assumptions are minus 26 for Australian shares and minus 53 for international shares. For kurtosis, positive kurtosis, 75% and 96%. These being based on the two-year points. Appendix A of the paper explains how we modelled skewness and kurtosis. It's not an easy exercise, and you'll see that we actually use two different methods depending on which sector we're looking at. And I'm indebted to Alan Brown for his help in the preparation of Appendix A for this purpose and Appendix B for another purpose. Now, the rank cross-correlations. By taking cross-correlations of the ranks are uniformly distributed. And this, again, is a technique I got from Alan Brown. The beauty of the ranks is that the resulting cross-correlations are far more stable than the cross-correlations of what we call standard cross-correlations. Standard cross-correlations are totally distorted by outliers and significantly distorted by just moderate fluctuations in the data. But these aspects can be overcome by the use of rank cross-correlations. They're much more stable. With both cross correlations, the same six-step technique was used to determine them, but we found it was useful to change the order. We did the projection at step two and rather than at step five. And as a result, what we have here is the red running averages as before, but we've got a few more of them because we're projected the information out 6 years. And now the trend line is just a 5-point central average, the green. This slide shows that shares correlated against W, which is average weekly ordinary times earnings, is 6%, and shares against W lagged 8 years is 8%. Those results are now fairly similar, but 14 years ago they were vastly different, 30 versus minus 2. This slide is an abridged cross-correlation chart. One interesting aspect of it is that CPI and AWOTI, which are financial indicators that are useful for picking up liability characteristics, are correlated against Australian shares, listed property trusts and fixed interest securities with a result of about zero. There's very little correlation between those sectors and CPI and AWOTI. But if you look at direct property and cash, you find quite a high 60 to 70% correlation between cash, direct property and CPI and AWOTI. So they're quite a good match for those liabilities. Of course, this work is just based on yearly observations. If you used an observation period shorter than 1 year or longer than 1 year, you could get very different results. Autocorrelations, they're dealt with in section 12 of the paper. Someone in the Melbourne audience was game enough to ask the question, what is an autocorrelation? So just briefly, autocorrelation is the memory of each sector. Autocorrelation gives you the correlation within the sector against its past results. Now, this chart, this slide just shows autocorrelations on a historical basis over 40 years for lags 1 to 12 years. It's based on yearly data at quarterly intervals. They're very similar, Australian shares and balanced portfolio. In fact, they're almost identical. The only difference is this little hump that exists in the balanced portfolio at lags 1 and 2. And that comes from the characteristics of listed property trusts and direct property. It's those two sectors being included in a balanced portfolio that creates that little hump. Apart from that, the results are very similar, indicating that it's the share sector that dominates the autocorrelation characteristics of a balanced portfolio. The share sector is interesting for another reason. Up to 5.5 years, it shows a negative autocorrelations, which is somewhat similar to mean reversion, because what that tells you is that shares have a characteristic of, or a tendency to bounce back from peaks and to bounce back from troughs that occurred in the previous 5.5 years, which is a little bit similar to mean reversion, except it doesn't necessarily mean they're going back to the mean. I personally feel more comfortable with the negative autocorrelation because it's working from the extremes rather than mean reversion, which assumes that you know what the mean is, and the mean is the hardest assumption to set of all of them. Now, if I've been suggesting that autocorrelations might be more useful than mean reversion, that will only be the case if there's some stability in long-term autocorrelations. So what we did was we broke the data into two halves. So for Australian shares, we looked at the 28 years shown in purple ending 1988-89. And compared that with the 28 years ending 16-17. So this is two non-overlapping 28-year periods. There's some similarities, but there's some differences that I'll explore in the next couple of charts. We did the same thing for 10-year bonds. For 10-year bonds, we actually had 67 years of data, so we broke it up into two lots of 33 years. 33 years happened to also be about the central point of the bond forces when they reached their peak. And we get remarkably similar results for the two periods, the blue and the purple, up to about 12-year lags. Just go back to shares for a minute. But this time, we expanded the x-axis of the old data by 60%. And by doing that, we've got the old data there over the first 15 years of the old data is charted over the same 24 years of the new data. And when you line them up in that manner, there is incredible consistency between the two periods. So what this shows is that the last 28 years, the same order correlation features are occurring for shares, but they're occurring more slowly, which is perhaps surprising for today's fast world. For bonds, the opposite story emerges. For bonds, we had to condense the data by 9%. So we showed the old data over 33 and compressed it into a 30-year period. And now we get virtually identical results up to 12, similar results from 25 to 30, and even the results in the middle, which diverge, reach peaks at the same point. So all of this, to Tom and myself, is indicating some stability of long-term order correlations. The autocorrelation assumptions were set using the same methodology as for cross correlations. So the blue curve on this chart is the assumptions, which is the 5-year central, the year two central average. We've compared that against the results for period naught, and you can see that they're, for all practical purposes, the same. In other words, there's again a stability of current Australian share autocorrelations. For bonds, up to a lag of about 25 years, the assumptions are virtually identical to period naught. Beyond 25 years, they diverge a little bit, and the blue assumptions for the future are occurring a little bit faster than the period naught results. Appendix B of the paper explains how we modelled autocorrelations. This slide explains the new arithmetic average means compared to the old ones. These are our new assumptions. New assumptions for all sectors are marginally reduced, except for inflation-linked securities where it remains unchanged at 7%. For cash, bills, bonds, and AWOTI, the assumptions have fallen by 0.5%. Table 16.1 of the paper gives a full set of the new assumptions. You've already seen the means. The coefficient of variation and the standard deviations, the detail behind them is set in section 7.5 of the paper. And on the right-hand side, we've shown the skewness and kurtosis assumptions. Section 12.4 of the paper explains the classifications of that. To summarise those classifications, those in red, there are two in red, we regard as extreme skewness and kurtosis. That's AWOTI and property trusts, listed property trusts. For high skewness and kurtosis, or high absolute results, the pink sectors are capital stable, domestic and international fixed interest, and direct property. The yellow shading is what we call moderate, and then there are five sectors less left where you might be able to justify using a normal distribution. Table 18.1 lists the assumptions gross and net of tax and fees. And I'll just focus on the results for a balanced and capital stable portfolios. For superannuation in the accumulation stage, the compound average assumption after tax and imputation credits and after fees is 6.83%. For capital stable, it's 5.6%, a difference of 1.23%. So by going conservative and moving from balanced to capital stable, you're giving up an assumption of 1.23%. And for a pension, same comparison, is a difference of 1.31. It's a difference between that and that. The next slide shows for a balanced portfolio, the real returns over average weekly ordinary time earnings. It shows the results over 58 years. The average over 58 is 1.64. The average is over 10 years in blue, which, as you would expect, are fluctuating all over the place. The average is over 20 years, which also fluctuate. The green 20-year averages prior 2014 are significantly higher than the red results over 44 years. And even since 2014, the green results range from 0.7% per annum to -0.5% per annum, different to the 44-year results. And they don't sound very much, but they're significant when you're dealing with a margin of 1.64. Similar results for CPI, but now the 58-year margin is 3.52. That's 3.52 compared to 1.64, but the same characteristics of the 20-year assumptions versus the 44-year red ones. There are three appendix to the paper. Appendix A deals with the modelling of skewness and kurtosis. It uses a normal power approximation for some sectors and a gamma exponential variable for others. Appendix B deals with modelling autocorrelations, and we show that shares are one extreme, bonds are another extreme, and all the other sectors, the other 13 sectors, fall somewhere between those two extremes. And what we've found is that with the other sectors, if we build in their cross-correlation features, that picks up reasonably the autocorrelation results that we want. Appendix C of the paper describes the OSMOD investment simulation model. The 26 inputs to the model are described on page 82. The model can be run in stochastic mode or in historical random start mode. Historical random start mode uses historical sequences and randomly moves the starting point. That's described on page 83 of the paper. And it's an interesting technique that produces, provided you have a long enough period, very similar results to stochastic results. Page 86 of the paper summarises the various algorithms underlying the OSMOD model. Concluding remarks are in section 20 of the paper. I've already mentioned that when setting long-term assumptions, it's important to analyse results over at least one full economic cycle. Two economic cycles is fine, but avoid one and a half economic cycles or a half an economic cycle. The sum of two sine curves technique is a powerful tool for analysing economic cycles. The impact of the GFC was not an isolated event. I've mentioned a couple of times that skewness and kurtosis assumptions for many sectors indicate that their return distributions are not normal or log normal. And there's a slight negative bias in balanced portfolio and share autocorrelations up to a lag of about 5.5 years. And finally, there's some stability in autocorrelation results in the long term. I'd like to, in particular, acknowledge the help that I've had from Alan Brown. Alan has helped me from the start of this journey, right through the journey to the end. Just yesterday, I got an email from him with suggestions about improving the skewness and kurtosis work. Without Alan, there would not have been the past papers. We would not have had the current paper, and I wouldn't have had the OSMOD model. He's been invaluable to helping me. I've also been very fortunate to build up a networking team of actuaries and others who have helped me over a number of years now in reviewing the paper and its predecessors. And finally, I'd like to give special thanks to Jeremy Waite. Is Jeremy here today? He's not. Jeremy wrote an article back in April 2009 called Black Swans, Fat Tails and Spherical Cows. It's a great read, and I've used extracts from that article at the end of a few of the sections under the heading Remember, and they're in a box. They're worth reading. Where we go from here primarily depends on Tom Sneddon. We're working currently on continuing quarterly data updates. We plan to change the model to a 60-year projection basis instead of a 40-year projection basis later this year. And Tom has under consideration the possibility of a paper in 2020-21. Thank you for your time, and there's some prompters for some further questions. And perhaps we'll go back to some of the ones that I passed on before.
All right, well, we obviously must have some questions on assumptions because Colin had to stop people asking questions, so I'll throw it open to the floor. John?
Colin, I'm very interested to see your assumption in regard to Australian equity shares. So you've got after tax imputation credits and fees, you've got 8.51%, so I could re-express that, I guess, as CPI plus 6%, given that you've got CPI at 2.5%. I mean, Colin, I wrote a book last year on financial strategies, and I wanted to demonstrate what was the long-term impact of using some of those. And for that, assuming growth inside a superannuation environment, I use CPI plus 5%. But I've been told by a lot of people, and when you look at it, a lot of the big industry funds are backing away from CPI plus 5% as being their rolling five-year return target. So they're tending to come back to 4 or 4.5%. And I was talking to a senior public sector fund manager who's advising some of the public sector funds on what they should say for their targets, and he's saying the same thing, that they're trying to tone that back a lot. So CPI plus 6% sort of seems a little on the high side relative to, what those industry funds and other asset advisors are doing. I just wonder if you have any comment.
Okay. First of all, an important point. We do all our initial work based on results before tax, before fees, and before imputation credits. So we establish all the assumptions before tax, before fees, and before imputation credits. Then, at the end of the process, we build in an allowance for, if required, an allowance for superannuation tax or life office tax and imputation credits. So we sort of come at it the other way around to what you did. And these results, for example, they're arithmetic before tax, fees and imputation credits. So it's a bit hard to compare what we've done against the approach that you've described. But part of the answer is that for bonds, we've assumed 5.5%. And for inflation, 2.5%. Now, they become the pegs. And then the risk margins get added on to the 5.5% to produce this. And the negative risk margin for CPI, it's not displayed here, the risk margin for CPI is actually a negative. it's 5.5 minus 2.5, it's minus 3. So to some extent, the 2.5 and the 5.0 are arbitrary, although the 3% difference between the two is not. The 3% difference is based on applying the methodology, with, and that includes a little bit of professional judgment, but not much in this case. But it's the relativity of everything else to those two which produces the complete set of assumptions. Sorry, I haven't directly answered your question, but I've basically tried to explain that we've come at it a very different way to the way that you've approached it, which doesn't mean that either is right or wrong. They're just for the purpose.
Can I just expand that, explore it a little bit further? The probability of that margin, is that 50%? Is that a sort of, that's an expected?
Yeah, I suppose you could call it a 50%. We believe it's realistic, so therefore it's a 50% type expectation.
My understanding is that when industry funds, when trustees are actually establishing their investment objectives, they're not looking at a 50% probability. They're looking at a 70% probability or something like that. So then I think that there's a significant difference there. And the second thing is, I just think that there's a marketing aspect about it, that basically the margin that they establish is promulgated in all their marketing material. They don't want to set themselves up for failure.
But if they're marketing their fund relative to other funds, wouldn't that encourage them to push the target?
Again, my personal view is that the bulk of members do not compare funds. They just look at what their fund has done compared to what they were promised. And if they were promised 5% and they got 3%, they're critical. Sorry, Colin?
Yes, Colin.
Great.
I think, Colin, you've made the key point, though. It's, you know, the difference between your bonds and your shares is only about 4.5%, which is not different. The critical issue is 2.5% inflation and a 5.5% bond long-term looking out. And I think that's probably the departure point of a lot of, you know, others at the moment is whether we'll ever see productivity improvements ever again, or whether the information age is going to kill it. Who knows? That to my mind is probably that's the debatable one. Really, that's the one that really rubber hits the road.
Next question. Over there.
I was just looking at, I guess, the mean return between Australian shares and international shares. I was just curious as to what, why Australian shares might outperform international.
I'm not an economist. I lent on the experience of someone who does have an economic background to help me with the setting of the two. And I can't remember the detail of the help that I got.
Colin?
It was dealt with a little bit of economic experience. Yeah.
Colin, I think Greg's offering to...
Well, I was going to say, there's a column, third last one, standard deviation, or beta. I think, don't forget, our Aussie market is dominated by... Because these are indexes, yeah? They're not necessarily... They're weighted by what's available in the market historically, yeah? And so our market's dominated by resources and leveraged things called banks. Not surprisingly, Australian markets always had a high volatility and a beta, I think, compared to everything else. So there's a higher return because there's higher risk.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world is a more diversified universe and it's got less leverage in it. That'd be my suggestion as to how you correlate those two things.
I will admit also that when sort of came up with this set of results, I did look at the very point that you've raised. I went back and looked at the relativity between the H sector and the I sector and compared it against another investment consultant's results, and I got comfort that his was in the same direction. So I'm not the only person that formed that conclusion.
Any other questions from the floor? I warn you, if you don't ask a question, I will. All right. Colin, one of the issues that I have with using historical data is that It appears to me that there are periods of performance that have occurred because of structural changes. The one that I'm thinking about in particular, two in particular, there was the 70s where there were significant structural changes that the outworkings of was effectively high rates of inflation, which then meant we had high rates of interest to overcome the high rates of inflation. We look at the GFC, I think that's structural in the sense that basically there was the development of synthetics into the property area, which basically came unstuck. The concern I have is that I have no doubt that we'll have structural changes going forward, which will have massive impacts on performance, but I'm not sure to what extent you can actually model the impact of structural changes, as I feel that they tend to be ad hoc and you don't really know when. You know they're going to happen somewhere, but you don't know when they're going to happen. So, yeah, I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
The structural changes you're referring to was, as I understand it, is sort of the 1970s, at that period through there. They're mentioned in the paper because I think it's somewhere in section seven, in section two, there's a reference to the fact that that period through there was a very volatile, abnormal type period. It was mentioned in the context of the 44-year running averages are attempting to pick up the recent trends, and they're weighted towards the right-hand side. But Alan Brown has pointed out to me that something that over a period of years I've come to appreciate more and more is that the running averages are also influenced by the dropping off at the left-hand side. So your point is very valid in the context of what's dropping off. But fortunately, the 44 years we're looking at just misses the worst part of that particular feature. And as I said, it's weighted towards the more recent results. So I hope I've sort of discounted that problem back into the past.
One question I have. If you go back 44 years ago, you're talking about 1973 or thereabouts, if my math is roughly right,
yep.
And the bond rates were very high, and the bond rates now are very low. So you have a structural thing which has increased the rate of return on holding bonds because you've gone from high to low, and increased the rate of return on equity, which has started off being valued in a high bond environment or a high cost of money environment, and now being valued in a low cost of money environment. So there's a structural shift between 1973 and now, which is running through all of these numbers, pushing up rates of return on bonds and rates of return on equity over what you would have if it was a stable situation, as in you had a starting bond rate and an ending bond rate that were actually the same. And I just wonder how you've allowed for that in doing your calculations and your projections going forward.
Those six steps which underlie the methodology, to some extent, I've hopefully picked up the structural change you're alluding to by that using the second year of that projection. So that's taken all the past movements, structural changes, and whatever, and has just pushed them out a couple of years. Rightly or wrongly, that's the technique that I've used. If there's any trend at all in all those structural changes, then I've anticipated that they'll continue for another 2 years. I picked up that result. So I'm picking up, in simple terms, 44-year averages expected in 2 years' times is basically my main assumptions.
Any other questions? All right. If I can say, Colin has prepared what I think we'd all agree is an exceptionally detailed and technical paper, and a paper that has lots of information in it. As actuaries, I think we love to have data. We seem to love to have past data so we can look at it, and supposedly we're very good at finding out what that past data means and using that to project into the future. Colin has given us some insight into his thinking, and he's thinking for some time on how that can be done in this area. And I'd just like to thank Jonathan, thank him for his speech, his paper. Thank you.